Well, what's going on, everybody? Welcome to this edition of Off the Record. We have a super special edition going down tonight. We got a special guest for y'all, and there's some like 4th District podcast crossover that you guys just are not prepared for. So excited you could join us today. I am Dan Duncan. You can hit me up on Twitter at Dan Dunk. I'm probably going to say something to piss you off, so I really hope you hit me up and tell me about it. I'm joined.
Most people try to mask that. He just like comes out guns blazing. I like it.
I love it so much. To my left is my good man, partner in crime at 4th District, Adam Bean.
Hey,
how are you, sir?
I'm doing well. This is rainy Bay weather here in Atlanta. Netflix and chill. So yes, I'm good.
And across from me is my good friend, Atlanta comedian, 4th District contributing writer in the past, but not so much recently, David Perdue.
I like how you did that. That was a call to action if I ever saw one.
just trying to motivate.
I appreciate that motivation. I'm good, man. I'm happy to be here.
Glad you're here. Yeah. And join us via the 4th District satellite. Our good friend from Clock Radio Speakers, Doc Beats. What's good, sir?
Oh, it's cold here. Not cold. It's cool up here in Connecticut. It's nice. You know, we got that walk around with a jacket, but not too heavy of a jacket weather. It's summer is hopefully gone. Let's all hope so.
Wait a minute. You in Connecticut? I thought you was like just couldn't make it today.
So coming up on Clock Radio Speakers is now hoodie music or hoodie hip hop music.
I am in a Yukon hoodie as we speak. So yeah, okay. It is it's getting close to hoodie season.
I like it. I like it. Well, you guys need to go check out Clock Radio Speakers if you have not checked it out. It is 4th District's partner in crime when it comes to all things music. They do an amazing job of breaking down and letting us know what's fresh and what is not so fresh. But tonight what we are going to talk about eventually and debate is the death penalty. There's been a lot in the news from executions being stayed and popes making writing letters on the behalf of people on death row in order to have them pardoned.
Like the official papacy, like not like Olivia Pope from like Scandal. Okay.
Right. I was confused there.
Yeah, word. That's what's up.
It can be confusing.
It can be.
And one letter might be more powerful than another. I'm not quite sure which one is which.
Fair enough.
But we're gonna debate the death penalty here in a little bit. But first, almost inescapably, we have to deal with breaking news. Today in Oregon, there was a mass shooting massacre. It's like Oregon City.
It was something. It's like something.
I was hoping Dan was going to try to pronounce it.
Yeah.
Umpqua.
Yeah. That's
Umpqua.
Okay. There we go.
It's a city college.
Yes.
Yeah. It's a community college.
Mm-hmm. And, 13 people were murdered. Cold blood.
Yeah.
At this point in time, 13 has been the number speculated. And all we really know is a male who has killed them. And then did he turn the gun on himself or was it
something?
Was there an altercation between police officers?
My understanding is that there was an altercation between police officers, that he was shot, but that he has survived. Is that true, Doc?
The latest I've read is that the police reportedly shot and killed him.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he was killed too.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. So it was, the only other thing I saw reported is that it was a long weapon, long rifle that was used.
Okay.
It was an assault
rifle, most likely. Mm-hmm.
Goodness.
So in today's day, I know the level of like callousness I have apparently at this, because this doesn't surprise me. Mm. It's not the days of like Columbine where like the very thought that someone could do this seemed like another world, an alternate universe. But what is I would love to gauge y'all's initial thoughts in reactions to this, and really like no filter. What is really going through your head the second you heard that this happened?
I was numb, honestly. When like you said, it doesn't register as it's sad. It doesn't even register as a thing anymore. It's almost like, oh, it's that time of the year again type of deal, which is incredibly sad in that regard. But yeah, I haven't, like, I'm not briefed on the news. I couldn't, like, I wasn't going to watch the news, like, and capture all of this, because I forgot the number of mass shootings this year in America, but it was some large number, and it was just upsetting, because you know, we've been through this. We know the talking points. We know the political talking points. We know the people who want, you know, the people who are going to have talk about gun control. You know, the people who are going to defend Second Amendment. So it's just like, all right, well, we're just let this storm die down, and then we will continue to not care. And then this will happen again in a few months, and we'll have no solution. So I'm pretty much numb to it.
Doc, what about you, man? What's been your first kind of reactions to this?
Unfortunately, it's not one of surprise. I think America is a uniquely violent nation. I think we're a violent nation. I think we're a uniquely individualistic nation. So, you know, we have this fetish for protecting ourselves, and that has evolved over the years. And along for the ride, this sort of historical aberration of how people view the Second Amendment has evolved, so that now it's, you know, people think they have a right to own a gun and do whatever they want with a gun, no matter what. And so I live in Connecticut. I live less than an hour away from Sandy Hook. When Sandy Hook happened, I used to work at the University of Connecticut, and I managed a bunch of students. One of my students who was working for me at that time, like, she was actually working at that time, like on the clock. Mm-hmm. She rushes over to me and she says, you know, I have to go. And she's like, well, my best friend's mom works at this school that just got, you know, just had somebody come in with a shooter. Mm-hmm. And like, to go through that and to see how America responded to, you know, of all things, that just as humans, right? Anytime harm comes, you know, the younger the victim is, typically the more incredulous people's reactions are. And the fact that we got past Sandy Hook, and we didn't change a single thing in this country about how we deal with guns, has pretty much led me to the place where if Sandy Hook couldn't do it, I mean, I'm not sure what can. So, it is not surprise. It is sadness.
Yeah. And I want to come back to the interpretation, because you, in fact, got your degree in political science, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And then from UConn, or did you do your math? Yeah. Okay.
I wanted to be a lawyer, and then I discovered all the paperwork of being a lawyer, and I decided, you know, maybe I want to do something else. That's another conversation.
Sure. I just want to give some people some perspective on, everyone knows I got my degree in history. Historical context means a lot to me, so it's good to know where you're coming from.
I got a whole lot to say about this. Don't worry. We'll come back to that.
Good. Cool. Adon.
Oh, I got my degree in English, so I can say words effectively. Now, the content of said words is questionable, but honestly, I would have to, you know, echo and parrot David and Doc's remarks. Like, I can't say that it is shocking. Unfortunately, what also happens is like the continuation of maybe you begin to piece together, because this has happened so often, you begin to piece together the narrative even before the details come out, and you just wait for them to fall in line. Mm-hmm. And that sounds callous, but it goes, okay. Like, I think at this time, all we know is that it was a male shooter, right? I'm assuming it's a white male.
Mm-hmm. Is that the assumption that we're all making? Because I'm in line with you on that.
I'm not.
Okay. Okay.
The only reason why I say that is because I think I read something where he asked for everybody's religion.
Right.
Where he asked people
that doubles down on why I think that. But you can continue.
Yeah. No. I mean, that was the only. Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know, but yeah. I'm just...
No, I think it's intuitive that you're like... Because, I mean, I pictured the crazy Colorado theater shooting kid that, like, was bullied. And there is this narrative. I think, unfortunately, the only thing that detracts from that in my mind is that the police shot him to death instead of taking him alive. Unfortunately, again, another stereotype, a trope in this story that we all live too often.
Right.
Yeah, so continue.
No, so you just start to line up these narratives around it and you say, okay, well, you know, I'm going to assume he's a white male. We'll see maybe in the time between this being recorded and being put out that we'll have additional information that disputes that. But that's the assumption that I made. I also make the assumption of responses, right? So I make the assumption to say, okay, this is what the NRA and lobbyists on that behalf are going to say about this issue, right? This, you know, and the push will be someone else should have been armed to defend against this crazy person, right? Like, it's never to remove guns, it's to inject more guns into the situation. I also make the assumption of what will be done about his character analysis and the care that will go into the nuance presented in terms of what led him to this point. And I think that that is a luxury, which feels weird to invoke the word luxury in such a tragedy, but it's a luxury that's afforded to white male mass murderers. That I do not think that I know doesn't happen elsewhere. Like, no one else is given that level of consideration to say, oh, was, you know, what are the mental health issues? What led to this scenario? Let's work to understand what type of family life this person came from. Not that it's excusable, but to provide a context for how this rage and violence could come about. And I just think that it's, those are the thoughts that begin to like form in my head when I hear a scenario. And over all of it, I would say that I definitely agree with Doc that it comes to this place where you go, man, this isn't enough. Like, this isn't enough to change anything, because what we saw in Sandy Hook wasn't enough to change anything. What we saw in Aurora wasn't enough to change anything. And what we see in inner cities across the country every day never gets discussed in the context of gun violence. It gets discussed in some other way, right? So those are like a lot of jumbled thoughts, but that's a lot of what comes to my mind when I think about this scenario.
Yeah, I think, and just to kind of finish it up, so I don't disagree with anything you said, but I do think there are a lot of people that will now give their, this is the solution.
Sure.
This is both political parties. We're in a presidential year.
Absolutely.
I mean, this is going to be a political debate on the Democratic side, on the Republican side. Stances on this will now...
It becomes a football that either side uses.
And unfortunately, in all of that, will be lost, the victims and the tragedy that this is. And I want to get into... I think it's beneficial to think through what should be done, what could be done. I don't think that those are tired conversations, clearly. And I think if you are a fourth listener and you're tuned in now, I think it is your responsibility not to just tune out people as they talk about these things, but you should come to your own conclusion about why you believe what you believe. Because I'm a gun owner, just to like put it out there. I own a gun. I own a gun primarily for protection in my house.
Be real, more than one or one?
I just have one.
Oh, okay.
I just have one gun.
That's a rarity.
I'm uncomfortable with the fact that I own a gun.
Interesting. Yeah, we've talked about that. Yeah.
My other gun is my 65-pound German Shepherd that I would much rather use in every way, shape, and form.
That thing will go after me and David every time we show up.
Yeah, we will get into the racial profiling that my dog does, unfortunately.
It's all good.
But, Doc, I would love for you, I think you have some words on kind of just the state of... gun legislation and just where we're at now, especially post Sandy Hook and post, I mean, these catastrophes that happen yearly. So would love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah. I mean, so my thought, I mean, what kind of drives me crazy and drives some other people crazy, and I don't know how you all feel about it, is this kind of myth surrounding the Second Amendment in this country.
Yeah.
And it's honestly, it's a result of, you know, arguably one of the most successful political campaigns of the last 50 years. Mm-hmm. So, you know, let me back up here. When we think of the NRA now, we see them, you know, in these press conferences after a mass shooting, advocating for, and I think it was a Don said, you know, advocating for, well, you know, if somebody else would have had a gun, right? Sort of this feeding into this sort of American myth that we have that we're all like, you know, going to reenact Die Hard in our homes, thinking that, of course, more guns will somehow be better. Prior to 1977, the NRA was about training, was about safety, and was somewhat about sport. They didn't advocate for self-defense. This might sound crazy to modern people, but in 1972, the Republican presidential platform, you know, it's a thing that they adopt at every convention. 1972 was the re-election of Richard Nixon, not exactly a liberal. It supported gun control. It supported specifically keeping cheap handguns out of people's hands. By 1980, that had flipped, and the Republican presidential platform opposed even federal registration of firearms. So what changed? Frankly, it was, I mean, honestly, in a weird way, it's reactionary backlash politics. The Republican Party and conservatives that made them up beginning in the late 60s and into the 70s, they thought the federal government was overreaching. There was forced busing. There was affirmative action. This whole civil rights thing, oh my goodness, you know, feminism was now creeping on these people. So there's this portion of America that felt like they had to defend like everything. And this paranoia about government begins to emerge. And there's always been strains of paranoia in this country. I think that's sort of a uniquely American thing, but it's certainly an American thing. Mm-hmm. And so in 1977 at the NRA annual convention, there was sort of a coup d'etat, if you will, of their leadership. And all of a sudden, they had a dramatic shift in leadership. And they immediately began advocating for Second Amendment rights. The Supreme Court didn't even rule that the Second Amendment guarantees somebody the right to own a gun unfettered until 2008. There was a law banning handguns in DC that the NRA had been after for years. The way the Second Amendment was written, and I'm sorry for getting on my soapbox here.
No, this is really good context.
We don't normally do dates on this show, so the fact that you are giving that, is amazing. Out. Please continue.
The Second Amendment is one of 13 amendments that was originally proposed by James Madison at the Constitutional Convention. He was a staunch opponent of a really strong federal government. So he wanted to make sure that there were protections. Not all of those amendments were ratified, obviously, but the Second Amendment, as originally conceived, was to make sure that there was a militia that could protect against tyranny. Mm-hmm. The great thing about the Constitutional Convention is because these are the founding fathers of this country and they are lionized, we've got tons of notes. There is nothing in James Madison notes, the man who proposed essentially that there is the right for a well-regulated militia. There's nothing about an individual's right to own a gun. There's nothing, frankly, in legal history up until really the last 50 years that ever suggested that there was this notion of unfettered access, you know, for an individual to be able to just get a gun. It was frankly a political campaign. It was a successful political campaign. The NRA has, you know, successfully convinced a sizable percentage of this country that the Second Amendment is this sort of, you know, well, there's a comma in there, and what does it mean for the right to bear arms in a well-regulated militia? This was written by people who lived in a brand new country.
Yeah.
A huge chunk of it was a frontier.
Right.
There was not the sort of organization, there wasn't sort of I want to say bureaucracy, but there weren't things like a police.
There wasn't a standing army.
Right. There wasn't a standing army. This is it was something written for a different time. The whole point was we have the citizens can have a militia because that's what, you know, that was a thing in the 1700s. Mm. It did not mean that I can own a semi-automatic rifle and I can carry it around wherever I want. That's not at all even remotely close to what it meant. And nobody not I shouldn't say nobody, the vast majority of people in our society did not think so until the 70s. So the idea that the Second Amendment is this like time-honored thing and that people have always had, have always had access. This is a modern invention. This is a modern interpretation mm-hmm. of the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. And it's good to note because there was revolts going on post revolution. We were under the Articles of Confederation, and which didn't give a lot of these kind of mandates. And
right.
And then revolts would happen, and there was no standing army to go put those down. And thus you had these local militias that were raised up in order to do that. And so I think it's really good context for people to understand. And I think that the paranoia is really, it is something uniquely American. And I'm going to be honest and say I have that paranoia for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. When you talk about like me registering my gun, like I don't love the idea that a government can know that I have a gun, which is weird. I'm just admitting this out loud.
Absolutely.
Because it's like I have such a distrust for the government that I think I'm very much in a V for Vendetta like mindset much of the time. That like I don't think that the American people are past giving a government so much power that they would then oppress their own people. And I guess I see that already happening to an extent.
So, you know, and I think that's, and I appreciate your honesty there. And I understand, I think to some degree that, I mean, I grew up in Ohio, which holds no bars around carrying, you know, guns. And, unless, you know, you're in a store on the phone like John Crawford, and then it's a problem. But to that end, I think that like, what other do you have that paranoia around any other things that you have to register with the government in terms of your automobile or, you know, like,
yeah. I guess it's really, it's foolish because what is my 9mm with 9 shots in it going to really do if the government wants to come and
realize that wasn't necessarily the point I was trying to make. Yeah. I just was curious if that concern goes elsewhere.
It really, I mean, I don't balk at, registering the fact that I'm married with the government.
Yeah.
I mean, or any other thing that gives them insight into myself. I think the paranoia does extend to things, it's escaping me right now, but like the law that put the Bush signed in that he could like read emails and
Patriot Act.
Mm-hmm. Like stuff like that does bother me. So I don't want to derail us and get us into this like, but I think it's something that it's like you said, and I'm like, that's true of me.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily true of just crazy people, that like, but at the same time, maybe there is a little craziness. So
the paranoia thing, people have to be held accountable for their people who do that. You know what I mean? Whether it's with political parties, whoever, organizations, like people are preying on paranoia. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? They're it's like, it's a propaganda. People like, that's a thing now. And those people aren't being held accountable. No one's stepping up and saying you're a huge part of the problem, mm-hmm. because it's all about, they use it for political gain or money or whatever. And it's like, there has to be people who stand up and say, okay, look, this is wrong. You can try to convince people, but like what you're doing is causing people to harm each other. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Out of that.
Preying on paranoia is the business model of Fox News.
Yes.
And it is the modus operandi of the Republican Party since, I'm going to say 1964.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that's exactly what it is, right? The Democrats have certainly played on paranoia at other times as well, but essentially the Republican Party for the last 50 plus years, all they're telling you is who to be afraid of and who to blame for your problems.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It is how a sizable chunk of this country has essentially, we have generations that have been raised this way now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I grew up on Sean Hannity, so I'm just putting all my business on the street.
Right.
But I grew up on Sean Hannity, and I still, it's I think I've said this before on previous shows. Like, I think he's gotten worse. I don't think he used to, but I listen to him now as like an educated adult versus being a kid. And I can remember like him blame shifting, which again is just another form of this like Fox News right wing conservative kind of motivation of whose fault is it that we're in, and it can't be our fault. And that's really the blame shifting thing. I think it happens. I think it's a human thing. I think we, like, as religious whole, like, people, like, whatever your faith is, it's not your faith's fault. It's another faith's fault. It's not your political party's fault. It's another political party. It's not, if you're rich, it's the poor. If you're poor, it's the rich. There's a lot of, I think, blame shifting, not a lot of people taking, responsibility. I think as we dive into this, though, I would love to kind of throw out the typical, I'll play the typical conservative responses to a situation like this, the talking points, and I would love for us to kind of dive into them and pull them apart. And if they're real concerns, let's call them what they are. They're real concerns, or but if they're not, let's destroy them. And I think that's what we hope to do here at Off the Record. So the first one that always comes up is more gun control doesn't equal less guns. More gun control just provides a higher need for a higher demand for the black market to step in and provide these weapons. How would y'all respond?
Say that one more time.
So the black market, so more gun control does not equal less guns.
Right.
That the black market, I mean, weed is illegal in the majority of the states in this country. Right. And do we, anyone that you know, have trouble finding weed?
No.
So making something illegal is not necessarily a solution for its presence.
Yeah.
So definitely for our listeners, this will be crude. But when I hear that, I think of it in context of an argument that's normally given around abortion, honestly, you know. And so the idea being that, you know, if you kind of from the left or, you know, more progressive sides, what they'll say is obviously like you can if you outlaw abortion, it doesn't stop the need for this, and that it will still occur, but it will be less safe. People, the women will be in greater danger, and we'll go back to a time in which, you know, people were doing things with hangers in back alleys and, you know, it doesn't. And so whether or not you grant that premise truth or not, I think that there is a level of, you know, this, I think it's a false dichotomy to say that we are banning guns, because that's not what's being requested. What's being requested is some type of control or some type of regulation to say, okay, you know, if it is about sport, why do you need the semi-automatic with the addition? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, yes. it becomes these other, and I feel like the push for them always gets shifted to, well, you know, it's about sport. Oh, well, I was raised this way. Or, you know, it's my right to, you know, it always moves to, like, the goalpost gets moved, or the metric rather gets moved to say, this is how you should be judging me for my guns. And it's saying, no, it's not saying you can't have this. It's saying if it is this, then these, we want to be able to have an understanding of, hey, maybe you should have a psychological check before you buy one, right? I think that's a logical thing to say. It's not to say, but that was one of the tenets of, or one of the pieces of the gun control reform that was introduced after Sandy Hook. And to see that something like that was controversial, I thought it was nuts. I thought this was insane. Like, I couldn't believe.
So to answer the question, I would be wary of, for the same reason. Okay, so this is weird coming from the white guy in the room, but I've seen what governments do with tests.
Okay,
and
right.
I forgive my paranoia, but it's like, but for the government to then have control to say who does have the right to have guns and who doesn't. I mean, again, I understand the logic, but I also understand that people use tests in ways they should not use tests.
Right, and I guess I just don't see the difference between the test you took to be able to drive your car on the street and the test that you took. I just don't understand the selective choice. And not you, but I've heard that argument before, but I don't understand. It's like, I'm okay with the government testing this, a 4-ton vehicle that has killed so many people and will continue to kill people throughout, you know, every, like, but I don't want them to be able to test the psychological, you know, balance of someone who's all, you know, being able to fire hot pieces of metal at a rapid, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. Sorry for interrupting. It's a little hard cause I'm here on Google Hangouts. I'm sorry.
Don't give away. Satellite. I was about to say, don't give away our secret.
We have our own satellite, bro.
I'm sorry. I'm here in the studio. Adan, I agree with you, but I think what people would probably say is, well, driving a car is not a right. It is a privilege.
Okay.
Right. We have decided that as a society, and a lot of people don't think that having a gun is a privilege. They think it is a right.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a real distinction there. Whereas, right. And I think what Dan was saying earlier about the whole paranoia thing, I think, if you don't think your government should know you have a gun, you definitely don't want your government to know that you're insane.
Yeah.
Or that some doctor thinks you're insane, if you want to take it to the next level of skepticism. Because we can call it paranoia, but we can also call it skepticism, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's somewhat
a nicer
related
way to say it.
It might be a little bit nicer way to say it. I mean, I think that's somewhat related as well. But no, to me, it's a privilege versus right thing.
Okay. I can understand that, but so that's the argument in terms of why, in terms of what would, I guess, double down on that perspective to say, no, I don't think that, you know, a psychological test is needed or necessary for a right, that I'm inherently given based on the fact that I'm a United States citizen, that idea.
I think it's interesting when every time this comes up, another argument that comes into it is the mental health piece.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's very interesting how people be like, we got to help people who are mentally ill. Or like there's this thing that has no real legs behind it, but it'll say, you know, we have to help out the mentally ill, but everybody's cutting. Like, I'm trying to figure out who's going to administer these tests. No one is, because everything mental health wise is getting cut. You know what I mean? So let's not act like we care about that now, like when you could have cared about it in legislation prior to, when there's so many people suffering from, you know, different things dealing with mental health. And now it's like, oh, well, let's do something about it. But you're not going to put the money up for it. So the people that are administering these tests will have no idea what they're doing, more than likely, or it won't be funded properly. So there's still going to be holes in the crack, or cracks in the idea.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's a good point. And again, returning to the fact that it is. I don't think anyone, like, on any side of this fence, I don't think is against, like, background checks to some degree. Like, I think that's...
Well, that's interesting. Like, background checks for what?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, my thought when it comes to background checks would be, like, obviously, criminal behavior...
That's fantastically interesting to me, because, like, we hopefully we'll get to talk about the death penalty later, but like, it's not, I mean, we have an interesting sort of dichotomy in this country where some people believe in the idea that like you are paying a debt to society, but then some people believe in jail as like, no, like, you know, once you're a criminal, you're going to be punished forever.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So like now you're getting, I mean, there's a whole other sort of layer there when you talk about background checks, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're getting into the systematic deal.
Yeah,
because
who's gonna be able to buy guns,
right? Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then a whole nother level of paranoia creeps in, that other, like, parent, this is so interesting, like, I understand the governmental paranoia. Mm-hmm. Right. And I've had this discussion with friends of mine who are very libertarian and like want the government out, and I'm like, well, I understand your paranoia, but I'm like, I've benefited from, you know what I mean, government intervening in certain things. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's not that I'm not paranoid, but I'm like, it can work in some instances. We just have to keep people accountable. You know what I mean? We have to keep the government accountable about certain things. But it's not, I don't know. It's just.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say, and I've always believed that everyone has their set of paranoias or conspiracies. Like, it's not that one side has,
right.
oh, you know, black people, they have all these conspiracy theories. Well, no, yeah, there are, but there are also these other, someone else has just a different set of conspiracy theories, right. Like things that aren't necessarily proven, but you suspect that this is probably the nefarious desire undergirding that mm-hmm. particular action. And so, yeah.
All right. So the next one that is all too often used is guns don't kill people. People kill people.
That makes sense.
People do kill people. People they use guns.
That's right. They use guns to kill people.
They use guns.
It's not that complicated.
Yeah.
And they do it a lot more efficiently and quicker and faster with guns. Yeah. Like
we don't say, you know, nuclear bombs don't kill people. People kill people. Yeah. Like, we've decided as a country that a private citizen can't own a nuclear bomb, right? Mm-hmm. We've decided that. Okay, cool. So now let's take it one step back. Like, okay, so private citizens can't own like armored tanks, right? Okay. That's cool. We've decided that's, even though armored tanks don't kill people, people kill people, right? Mm-hmm. So we roll that back. So exactly what is the difference? A gun
is
an instrument to kill something, whether it's for sport or not, right? It's not you, like, you know, there are like knives you can buy and people say, oh, well, you could just kill someone with a knife. Yeah, you could cut, you know, you could also like, you know, chop an onion with a knife. Like, it's very difficult to regulate things that have multiple uses. But unless I'm missing something,
how do you think the cheese gets Swiss though, if not by an assault rifle? Okay.
Like, unless I'm missing something, guns are made to kill something.
Right.
Yeah. Is there any other use of a gun I can think of?
Put holes in paper.
Right. Yeah. You're killing an animal or you're killing a person.
Yeah.
Paint guns, right. But those are, you know.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, so I don't know. We've decided, like, you know, yes, I mean, that is true. People kill people. However, there are certain things that as a society, that, as you know, as a group of people that have a government that we elect, we have decided there are some things that are just too dangerous to be allowed unfettered.
Yeah. Every time I hear that,
it's just a question of why don't guns qualify for many people?
Yeah. Every time I hear that argument, like guns don't kill people, people kill people, I just want to ask, like, why? Why is America better at killing people than everybody else? You know what I mean? Like, American exceptionalism has to stop somewhere. You know what I mean? Like, why are we better at it than ever? There's something going on here. You know what I mean? So you can have that argument. Whoever has that argument, have that argument. Now ask yourself why we do it better than anybody else. Why don't other countries do it as well? You know what I mean? What is going on here that is causing people to be like, you know what, a thing that I should do to when I have a problem is to go into a school and kill dozens of people because I have a problem. You know what I mean? Like, what are we doing here? We have to think critically about here in America. What is it that we're doing that no one else is doing? You know, because I think it was a statistic that there's only been 275 days or something like that in this year, and there's been 290 something people who have died from mass shootings or something. Or I don't even know if that's the people that have died or the actual mass shootings, but like, that is ridiculous.
Yeah.
So it's like, you can have that argument about guns, but it's like, You have to come to the conclusion, if you're going to be that person, say, we're doing something wrong. Like, we're not doing this right.
I mean, how do you think America... I mean, that's American exceptionalism, sir.
We're killing each other.
I'm so joking.
Yeah. I got you.
But that's... Yeah.
So, is it not a first world problem? And I mean that with 100%. Like, seriousness.
How many other first? What are the other first worlds? What are the other?
That's my point. Is that we are the first? Like, America is the first world.
Just ourselves. Like, this, we're not talking about London England or France or like those. Don't those are
That's a good point.
You see what I'm saying? They don't do this.
I think there's a level of isolation that America, the American dream, has produced. Which is, I think, actually speaks to why the perpetrators of these mass shootings typically are white males, because they are most definitely the products of most likely like this American dream idea.
And I think even that rugged individualism that I think Doc was mentioning early in the remarks, like, I think that there's a ethos that's housed a lot in the white American male, the manifest destiny, the open frontier, the desire to tame the wild, like, you know, and that I'm painting with the broadest of brushes possible, but
I mean, I think you painted me, but I don't have this like overwhelming desire to end someone else's life. So
no,
I don't think that those things are inherently lead to
no, I don't that. Think so but either. But I'm describing a concept. I'm describing a context in which something like that arises. And that's not to, right. that's not to condemn the context. It's just to say, okay. we've got to account for what we at this point, we can't avoid the similarities. And that's what I think.
Sure. And we should pretend that there aren't similarities, right. which I think we white America would love to pretend that these are anomalies.
Right.
And
these just keep being one-off cases. We'll say, well, at a point we got to say all of these one-off cases look alike.
And Doc, what were you going to say?
I was going to say a couple things. That's my problem. No, I think it's sort of a false choice, right? Where it's like, you know, it's like, well, you know, I didn't turn out that way. So if I didn't turn out that way, then it can't be the reason why. And it's like, well, you know, much like sort of, it's to me, it's similar logic where it's like, well, you know, gun control won't really work because there will still be guns in the street. It's like, well, it's not like all or nothing, right? It's not like either every white male who grows up in this scenario, you know, mm-hmm. start shooting up schools or none of them do.
Right.
There are degrees and there are things that make it more likely. And we have a society where it is more likely that this will happen. That's all. It's not a question of will it ever happen or will it never happen. Mm-hmm. It's a question of degrees. It's a question of how many more times likely is it to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to throw out one last one that's I'm sure to get, especially from Doc and Adon, some thoughts. This is a product of hip hop music, writing songs about driving down the street, blowing people away.
I don't think what's my man named Dylan Roof was listening to hip hop music. You know what I mean? Like that's
I'm playing.
No, I'm not. Playing, I know. I'm just yeah. I'm not speaking to you directly. I'm just saying like God, that's the most ridiculous and clearly there's a race. You know what I mean? It's racist BS that's out there. Like. You know, I don't think the people that are designing Grand Theft Auto are a bunch of black dudes sitting around. You know what I mean? Like, we're going to
We can couple that. I mean, I don't necessarily want to make it a race issue. I want to make it a violence in our entertainment issue.
Yeah, I'm just saying, when I hear hip hop, I think black people.
Sure.
And so most people who would say that, believing it, would be like, oh, it's those black people. See what I'm saying? So that's the only reason why I use that context.
Yeah.
So it's like, I think that to speak to a bigger issue, it's like, it's the people who would say that if they were, it would have more to like just the violent culture. I think you're speaking to like, it's the violent culture. And it's like, all right, well, again, why are we so violent? Mm-hmm. Why do we get off on creating things that are about violent, that are so violent here? Why is that a thing that's a part of our culture? And then we sell it to other countries too. You know what I mean? It's not just like that's a part of what we export violence. You know what I mean? As if it's a thing that like makes you like a better person, even. You know what I mean? Or I don't know. To me,
this is sort of broad to say, but I don't think it's that far from the truth. America is unique among countries in that maybe not the only country, but certainly one of the very few that. Our entire, like the backbone of our entire society is based on violence and rape and pillage.
Yes.
We, you know, this, like from day one,
right.
People came over, took a land that wasn't theirs,
yeah.
systematically killed and drove away people who were living here.
Right.
Then in order to build the nation, in order to farm the nation, in order to create wealth in the nation, they then violently enslaved an entire race of people.
Yeah.
Then once those people finally theoretically got their freedom, they then systematically decided, how can we oppress them?
Right.
How can we be violent towards them? How can we deny them their right? Like that is the American way.
Yeah.
Violence and taking from those who
it just
cannot defend. It is the American way. It is the most uniquely American thing that we do.
Right.
And I think gotten better at it.
We have gotten better, but I would also say that I think that's the reason for the culture is because I've compared it on stage and I've worked, but it's very much so like a big brother syndrome. You know what I mean? In the sense of like, if you're an older brother, like, you know, you've done some things, right? That like to your younger brother, or like, I'll just speak for myself, I've done things to my younger brother growing up that like, now that before I was a full adult, I was like, this dude should probably want to do some things to me because of what I've done. So, you know, it's an inherent paranoia because we know how we got to this greatness. We all know how we got to this greatness. So in our minds, we're like, whether it's anybody now, it's not even just white, it's like America. Like, so it's like, we know that people should be coming for us. whether it's white people thinking about, you know, so that you could pay into the paranoia about, well, the black people will come and get you because of these things or whatever. Like, or even like in an American thing, like, we need our guns because we don't know, we don't want ISIS to come over here and do it or whatever. But it's like, we've done things to people and we know just off being a human being that, like, things come back to you. So that is like, we're very unique in that regard. It's like, we know we have
prone
not
to violence.
We are prone to violence and we've conquered because of violence and we've done been the best at violence, and somebody, not everybody's happy with us.
We're prone to violence, and then we romanticize individualism. Right. We think of, you know, the famous painting George Washington leading the men across, you know, the frozen Delaware River in the, you know, Revolutionary War. Like, it's an image you saw in history books. We're not talking about, like, the whole support crew that got the army to survive the winter. We think of George Washington, right? Think of, like, you know, Westerns, and it's always the hero with the gun, or like, that's you combine our, like, fetish for the individual rising above all, and the way that we've exported that in our media, you combine that with our violent society, and yeah, you got crazy people with guns. Like, it's not like, how did we get here? It's a question of considering, like, how that, now that we have painted ourselves into this political corner in this country, how do you get out of it?
Yeah.
That's the real thing. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a great point. And I think, can it kind of lead us to kind of wrapping this up before we, dive into, the death penalty. What can we do? I mean, we are in the corner. We're all coming at this from various different angles, but I know that we potentially are, speaking to a choir or whatever we're doing here and talking about potential solutions, but realistically, what can we do as individuals to change these things? Like, is there hope, or is this just something that, like, you would literally have to leave this country in order to escape the very violent nature that is the DNA of America?
I mean, yeah, I feel so helpless to say, but, like, that feels like the only solution, because I feel like here in this country, maybe more of any other country, we've just devalued life. Like, we don't care, like, as a whole, we don't, it is literally nothing for someone to be like, I don't like you, therefore the result of just this disagreement is, like, your life must end, you know? And, like, that's just, we just think that is just a normal thing. We've devalued life to the point where mass shootings, like I said, are even.
And this isn't, and mass shootings isn't the only way. Pornography, sex trade, through
there's so
drug
many,
use,
yeah.
Through the American dream as being, using everyone as a means to an end. I mean, there's a million different ways that plays itself out. But
right.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with you.
Yeah, that was my point. I was like, yeah, I would tend to agree with you. Like, it seems hopeless, but it's like, where do you go? Because every other country is kind of wanting to try to be like America.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So it's like, it's only a matter of time before that export gets there and it blows up, and then, you know, there's, you know, the same thing happened there that's happening here.
Yeah, I mean, it's impossible. Like, it's funny, when me and my wife are traveling abroad this past summer, and we met a few different couples from America, and the conversation always went to American violence. And so I think there are a lot of countries that want to be like America, but I also think a lot of people, like European citizens, and understand that we are a very violent nation.
Yeah.
So maybe there's hope for the rest of the world. I don't know. Adon, what do you think, man?
Oh, man. I don't know. It's a weighty question. My general stance has always been that the, like, that revolution is always personal. And so it's the idea that we have to change our individual actions. We have to change our children's actions. We have to affect our loved ones and our communities. And it's tough to say that in a context of violence and gun violence, and to tell the kid right in East Baltimore, on the, you know, south side of Chicago, or someone who's just experienced a tragedy, and just be like, well, you know, just you know, refrain from whatever. But really, the way in which I think about it is just the context of saying, like, you know, so I have a nephew who's 4 years old. Like, what am I teaching him regarding conflict, de-escalation, right? And the way in which to manage emotions and anger, and letting him know that, like, that your pride, you know, can survive not having to react violently to an offense. You know what I mean? And those are, that to me is the way in which, that's the way in which I take a responsibility on a very personal level. And I would think that if more people, you know, even critiqued what I just said, but if all of us thought in the context of saying, how can I actually change the people, myself first and those around me, then we would maybe start to lay the bedrock ideologically to maybe think about changing laws and society and the overall impression of what we do with guns in our country. I don't know. And what type of entertainment we desire. Mm-hmm. That's another thing, but yeah.
Doc?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's been a 40 to 50 year sort of journey of political change in this country to get us to the state we're at like right now. So there is no like, hey, let's propose a bill, or let's get a law passed, because that's not going to solve all of the problem here, because there are a lot of problems. I mean, somebody pointed out before the issue of mental health. It's often brought up. That's actually like a legit issue, right? We don't fund mental health well in this country. That's one small piece of a problem, right? It's like, okay, if you don't want people to have to register their guns, and if you don't want people to have to take a mental health exam because you don't want the government to know, all right, well, cool. Well, why don't we not slash funding for mental health at the very least, right? There's a lot of things, some of them coordinated, some of them not coordinated, a lot of decisions that as a society we have sort of evolved and crept towards that have gotten us to this corner, and it will take a long time to get us out. So it's not that I'm unoptimistic. It's just like people have to be realistic about what change looks like. Like even if there was a mass uproar, if there was like, we're going to change it, we're going to pass, you know, some amount of gun control, just implementing that. And then like, there's the violent nature of America. There are still people who are still going to have guns, who still have mental health issues, or people who like that. It will take a very long time. I just want to make sure people have that, like have that sort of sense of how much time it
the
can
long
really
view.
Take to
the
affect
long
change.
View.
Yeah.
There's reparations.
Right. It's like
that should be paid.
Well, that's all about reparations. no, it's,
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, no, all that to say, I don't think we're going to solve this tomorrow. I hope that we can start to see the beginnings of sort of the tide shifting, perhaps. That would be what I would hope for.
Yeah, so I don't disagree with what you just said. I do think that every action has an equal and opposite reaction. So to say that you're going to fix something that's taken 40 years to put in place and to get to, it's most likely going to take that long to see any significant change. I will say, though, that I think that I'm all about self-responsibility, and I think that this is something that literally we are in this place because we have isolated certain people, and because we deem them unhelpable, we deem them weird, we deem them, in this specific scenario, of people that go off the deep end because they have no one to talk to and they need to make this point and blah, blah, like, and maybe I'm stereotyping, but I do think that if we simply look around us and engage the world around us, that we don't isolate ourselves via Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and these things that cause us to be far more lonely, even though we are quote unquote engaging far more people. I think that you genuinely can, that the world can, as we engage these people like that we have rejected as weird, then they have somebody they can talk to. And I feel like, Doc, you said this, like there's no, like we've slashed this funding, like professionally, where can we go? And we've demonized mental health to the point that to even admit that someone would have a mental health issue, they're too far gone. There's nothing that they could potentially do to help. And so I think mental health is a real thing. I think, and helping people is as simple as looking around you and getting your head out of your phone. And how many times, like, you never know, like even in my own life, like today, like For those that don't know, I quit my job yesterday. Like, the amount of conversations I had today of people just, like, stopping me, engaging me, like, it meant something today. It meant something more today than it did on normal days. And so, and I know that I may be stretching here, but I honestly believe that we can change this by not pointing fingers at people and taking responsibility on ourselves and saying, okay, how can I engage the world around me to a place that I'm open to helping people be themselves, and regardless of maybe being weird and different, like, we accept them. And so, I don't know. You guys may think I'm crazy.
No, I was going to piggyback on that. Mental health is more than a diagnosis. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I think that's a good way to start looking at it, instead of saying, like, you don't have to be, you know, one of the many different things that are diagnosed, but, like, just checking on people's, like, actual mental, like, day-to-day health is something very important. It's something that we don't do enough in this country. Mm-hmm. Or just, I mean, just in general in the world, I don't think we do, but, like, just having the idea of, like, how are you literally, like, you know, and actually caring about people.
And also to realize that you, speaking to all people, like, you are capable of such things. To, like, to deem yourself, like, other, like, I could never do this. Mm-hmm. I can understand why you would think that, because I probably even thought that in this podcast as we sit here, but it's dawning on me in this very second. Like, I'm no better than this person. I just have family and friends and other people around me to encourage me and to cause me to come back to earth in the moments of, like, the most anger. And so I can honestly say I'm not any better than these people that went off the deep end. I guess maybe. I think that's right.
So along those lines of kind of empathy and, you know, constant consideration of we're all one wrong decision away from maybe going awry. Some people make wrong decisions and they commit a crime in which they are then sentenced to death. Like the woman here in Georgia named Kelly Gissendener, I think is how the name will be said at this moment and probably not repeated for the rest of the podcast, because we're not sure if we're saying it correctly. Right. But I think, you know, I think it's an interesting kind of conversation to have, because, you know, the idea is that society has deemed that there, that this someone could be judged based on their actions, and then not just have their freedom taken from them, right, but ultimately have their life taken from them by the state. And it was an interesting conversation. This was the first woman in 70 years, I think, here in Georgia to be put to death. It was the last woman on death row here in Georgia, and also it garnered a lot of attention because the Pope was here. And he weighed in on it, in the, I think he sent a letter through an emissary or something along those lines that pleaded with, the state of Georgia to provide a stay of execution and to basically not kill this woman. But this woman had, she didn't commit the murder, but she hired or she convinced her boyfriend to kill her husband, and I think this was like back in 97 or something along those lines. And there were two kids that were, you know, that her and her husband had two kids who survived. They weren't the target of anything, but just there were two children who were pleading on behalf of the state to, even though the mother had killed the father, to keep her alive. And but yet and still the parents of the deceased husband certainly wanted justice as they saw it. And so I think it's an interesting kind of point of departure to make through that conversation of just saying what are we all capable, and what, you know, that possibility, what, I mean, I don't know, what are our thoughts around the idea of the death penalty in general?
As I mature, I think when I was a much younger man, I was very much so pro death penalty. Uh-huh. Right. And then you get older and you realize, like, so when was she was executed Wednesday, right? Today is Thursday. Are we a better Georgia? Friday. Are we a better Georgia now that she's dead? Are any of us better people? Are we any safer? Are we any, you know what I mean? Like, where as a society, if we're going to deem as a society that we can do this, right? Where is the good?
So the argument to fulfill my role as devil's advocate.
Yeah.
The argument is that the perception of like threat that is the death penalty does make this society better. I'm not going to stand behind right. that statement, but
right.
that's how some a proponent pro-death penalty would right. sit here and say, yeah, the state is better because now
people
someone
are afraid.
Plotting their husband's death is like, oh,
yeah.
this could kill me too.
Oh, yeah, because we kill less people now than we ever have, right? You see what I'm saying? Like, that's a ridiculous argument to me. I understand it, but it's like, we don't kill less people now, and everybody knows the death penalty is out there. We kill more people now. No one's afraid of the death penalty.
What's interesting is that in 1972, I think, which kind of is interesting since Doc has us on dates, mm-hmm. Which I really appreciate.
I don't. I know that much.
basically, the U.S. Supreme Court basically stayed all death penalty. But then in 1976... Greg versus Georgia basically reinstated the death penalty. So there was this
Georgia leading the pack.
4-year hiatus of potentially what could have been a mass change, and then obviously we headed back towards the being pro death penalty. And I mean, it just feeds into the theme of the whole night of like America uses violence to protect itself, and. Uses violence as moral grounds to or to try to instill moral grounds on others. And we do this across the world. We do this here at home. And so American exceptionalism is something, a beast of its own. Doc, what is your point of view on just the death penalty and I want to kind of get into the Pope's call that all human life is valuable, and therefore there should be no such thing as a death penalty anywhere in the world.
Yeah, the Pope's call is interesting, but real quick, I mean, what I would say is, I think there's two reasons why you can, and maybe there are more, but to me, it seems to me there are two reasons why one might advocate for the death penalty. On one hand, you might say, well, it deters crime. There's actually no evidence of that. States have been executing fewer and fewer people actually over the last 15 years. There's a case in Oklahoma right now. Somebody mm-hmm. last name Glossop, I think.
Yep.
So one problem that states have is they've been trying to get around the death penalty, but basically it's been difficult to get the right chemicals. Actually, it's right. sort of weird situation. So violent crime has actually been overall falling in this country. Mass murders are not, but overall violent crime has been falling, and yet there were fewer and fewer executions. So, and then just in general, like any scholarly literature you read, basically there's no evidence of deterrence. And then, so the other reason you might want it is a sort of, frankly, retribution, right? Justice. Mm-hmm. You killed this person, or you did something horrible to these people or some group of people, and as a result, you will be killed. I mean, seriously, there are lots of people who they see it as like no joke. Like it is,
an eye
this
for
is
an eye.
Justice. This yeah. is right. Literally eye for an eye. Right. And that sort of goes back to, I sort of referenced it before. Like, what do you think the point of prison is? Right. Is it retribution or is it rehabilitation?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so in this country, we love to talk about rehabilitation, but man, do we love our retribution?
Right.
Oh, love yeah. it.
We yeah. love the justice. We love the notion of it's black or it's white. It's bad. It's good. Nothing gray about it. Nothing in between. You kill somebody, you should be killed. Boom. It's good. Let's go move on to the next person. Like there's a strain of that runs through America. Like I, on both accounts, like I just don't understand like the death penalty at this point. Like I grew up like in a household that was like, you know, I remember my parents talking about it, like, you know, in the 90s as a kid, like, you know, eye for an eye basically. Right. And it's like, okay, sure. That kind of, weirdly, there's a simplistic logic to that, but like, I don't know, like, it doesn't deter crime, and it's not, you know, you guys pointed out before, it's not making us safer. It's not making us better. We are not a better place because this person no longer exists on this earth. Like, and then there's just like the logistics of like, it's expensive to kill somebody, to go through the appeals, to go through the process. You're wasting money. You were spending a lot of money,
taxpayer money,
to probably actually not kill this person. And if you do kill this person, you've spent a lot of money to do nothing.
Right.
It is a waste of time. It is a waste of life. It is a waste of money. I do not understand the death penalty.
So that to give some perspective, to try someone all the way to a final death penalty like ruling, it's about $1.2 to $3.6 million per case. And so yes, it is very expensive. And so life without parole, again, proponents of the death penalty would say life without parole cases are about 3 to 10 times more expensive than death penalty cases. That is just a stat that has been
$3 million.
Between $3 and $10 million potentially for a life without parole.
Well, I think we found our answer.
Potentially because you would have so many parole hearings in potentially a life without parole opportunity like case throughout the lifespan of that prisoner. But that's getting off the point. But I do think the whole cost thing is something I've heard of before, of like, well, just kill them because we're sitting there, you're saving money in the fact that you don't have to feed them, whatever. It is crazy expensive to go through that process. So it's not a legitimate argument to say that by killing people it's cheaper.
And I am also of the thought, so to put my cards on the table, similarly, I guess I kind of grew up thinking like as a kid, not that I'm like, yay, death penalty, but that as a child, there is a childlike logic that makes sense that, you know, there's a level of punishment I receive if I do something wrong. I don't die, thanks, mom and dad, but there is a level of understanding that if I do something wrong, there's a reaction to it. And so you go to someone and you give them a bumper sticker line, not to make the Bible a bumper sticker, but eye for an eye, it makes sense in a very simplistic way. I also, my father is a defense attorney who tried most exclusively capital punishment cases. Like that's what he's done for the majority of his life. And so I've gotten to see and know and meet families impacted by someone who's on trial under these cases. And my father still has relationships with people that either people who are either he was able to get them life, or people, fortunately, I know at least a couple families who they were brought all the way to the conclusion of a death penalty case. And so I think that there's all these elements to it. I know my father's perspective on that, which I respect him for, is just that he believes that, you know, everyone deserves an advocate. You know, no matter what you've done, you deserve a someone in your corner, at least reinstilling or speaking to the humanity that you have. But more than that, in this case, what gets me is that I'm concerned about like the pro death penalty faction often, like, where does this trust in the state come from that people like you, like, why is the belief that the state got it right this time? Like that the trial was just, that everything presented was accurate, and that the decision made sense. Like I don't understand the selective belief in state to say like, you know what? The state should be able to decide to kill someone.
Yeah, that paranoia, that governmental paranoia turns off real quick.
I don't understand that part, but
I mean, historically, the only really time you see large full scale capital punishment being doled out is during revolution. And so, for me, it's very interesting to see a society that's not currently in a state of revolution to be turning to capital punishment. So for me, historically, that's my biggest qualm with it is like typically it's a turning of who has power. So, I mean, French Revolution happened and those with power were executed and murdered and to create room. So let's talk about, I mean, this idea that Pope Francis, is that who is the current Pope, right? Pope
Francis. That's known as Cool Pope.
Cool Pope, Humble Pope. He makes a statement that I think all people are humanity is valuable. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think this is a loaded question, but is there an argument to say that like taking someone's life is not necessarily to take away that value, but to simply hold one accountable for the very actions that they knew could be potentially a consequence? It's not like these people didn't know what they were doing or when they were committing a crime that this was a possible outcome of, hey, if I plot my husband's murder, that I thought I would just get life without parole. I mean, there is, you grow up hearing if you murder someone, there's a chance that you're gonna be on death row too. So help me, Mr. Devil's Advocate, understand, like, if you know the consequences of your actions, why does the state taking that person's life demeaning their value when in fact they're just taking responsibility?
First of all, I don't think we can assume that people make logical sort of,
right?
They're not like making a cost benefit analysis about.
That's probably true. Yeah.
I don't think we can assume that all people are creating Excel sheets outlining their options.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to be flippant. Like, really,
speak for yourself, killer.
Yeah. Don't save that to your Google Docs. Like, Google might come after your, come after your account. No, I mean, it's funny because you were talking about personal responsibility before, right? And you would hope, you always want to hope that, yes, people are aware of all the possibilities of their actions. But I don't know. The whole idea of, how do I put this? Like, I have a lot of thoughts about about this whole notion of should we kill people for any reason at all, right? I mean, you can take this to like a logical extent. You can go, well, why do we fight wars?
Right.
Why are we dropping bombs from drones for people who didn't even go through a judicial process? But then, you know, okay, so maybe we should or shouldn't do that. And then on the vice versa, like, we have a really, I just said overall, I'm sort of rambling here, but it's like, we just have a really interesting relationship with violence in this country. Mm-hmm. It's the theme of the show, right? And so I think it's, I don't know if it's as much violence as I think it's really just, you know, there is such a strong attraction to simple answers to complicated questions.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that this thing happened that is awful, the idea that there is a simple, and people don't want to hear the details, right? The death penalty, people advocating for the death penalty, you're not making a plea to someone's intellectual side. It is a instinctual, guttural, like,
right,
this is justice. Right. We're cutting through all the crap. I mean, when people advocate for the death penalty, I'm guessing advocates of the death penalty probably hate the fact, or maybe hate's a strong word, they really aren't fans of the fact that they're, in fact, takes so long to get somebody to actually be murdered.
11.3 years between sentencing and you know, yeah.
Right. I'm guessing advocates of the death penalty would like to see that shortened quite significantly. Mm. And then if that were to happen, then all the questions about cost and everything else, well, that goes out the window too, right? I mean, people advocate for the death penalty in this idealized state. Someone did something, it was proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that they did it. Now, of course, there's all sorts of things that can go wrong along the way, but that's not what people are thinking about, right? People are thinking, this horrible thing happened, I want to solve this problem. I think that's the appeal of death penalty. I don't think it's, you know, I don't think it's anything more than that.
So are the family members, we'll just take the lady that was murdered in Georgia. Her final appeal, her children gave a final appeal for her to be saved. And then the hearing turned to the victim's parents.
Yeah.
To hear what they'd have to say. And they continued to ask for her life to be taken.
Right.
Or for justice to be had, however they stated it.
They stated it essentially saying she has had more advocates on her behalf than she ever allowed our son. Right. Like she didn't allow all this time that we're providing her, all these, you know, whatever, appeals and all this stuff. Like, she never offered that to our son when she killed him. So, you know, blah, 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 blah. Yeah.
So what? So now she doesn't deserve to live? Is that pretty much what it is?
Yeah, pretty much.
You're giving it up.
It's so easy for us. Like, it's very easy for us to, because...
If my wife... So I was going about to make this like personal. If my wife is taken, I'm trying to put myself in their shoes.
Right. Yeah.
And I think I agree with Doc, though, because it's like, I'm rambling now, too.
I bring it out, everybody.
Don, when we were talking about the woman who was killed, or the person who was killed, and the mother forgave the shooter and said, "You've robbed me of my daughter, but I forgive you." In the Charleston shooting.
Yes.
And the comment was made, man, isn't it amazing to see this person love this murderer with the love of Jesus? And your response, not to put your business on the street, was like, I'm tired of having to see black mothers be Jesus.
I didn't say it exactly like that, but he is accurate in the sense that I had a level of anger around the entire situation, and the fact that often in these cases, whether it was Freddie Gray or Charleston or Trayvon or whatever, like, the mother is trotted out. And one of the early questions that is asked to this grieving mother is, do you forgive the killer? Do you feel like they're always pushed to answer that question? And I just think that it's no other way to say it. I just think it's while I appreciate the idea that someone could overcome that and like work in a way of forgiveness as a believer, as a Christian, I even appreciate that. There's a rage that I have that, like, give these people time to deal with very human emotions. And I feel like there's a level of convenience that's being that makes people, makes white America, to be very honest, like, operate in pushing black people mourning to move from mourning to forgiveness too fast. Whereas you have I think the mother of Nicole Brown Simpson, like, they're still writing books talking about, like, never forgiven. You know what I mean? Like, to O.J. Simpson. Like, I just feel like all emotions are valid, and I feel like it's people should be given time to deal with all of those emotions. So I want to be very clear that it's not that I'm like, yo, that person should never be forgiven, blah, 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 blah. If they were able to work through all of that, praise God. I don't know if I'm in that situation, if I can do that fast, honestly. And part of it goes to this whole conversation goes, that's why I should not be the judge around whether or not someone's life, you know what I'm saying, gets taken. Because like you said, if you kill my parents or my brother or my nephew, I do want vengeance. I am not faulting the parents of the man who was killed, right? I'm not faulting them for saying, hey, no, I want justice. I want this person to kill. I just think that they are operating in a way that is completely human and completely understandable, and they should be given the right to operate in that. I just do not believe that the state should take that perspective to say, we are going to now
on your behalf
we are now going to kill this person. Like, I just, that's my personal stance on it. But
no, yeah. I think it's really good. I think that's enlightening. I don't think anyone on this podcast would argue differently, that human life is valuable. Mm-hmm. And no matter in what state that human life is in, or stage of life they're in, or whatever they've done, that there's intrinsic value in the very fact of having Imago Dei, or the image of God on them, and very Christianese term, apologies, but like that's the root. If you're a Christian, that's why you should value all life, is we are made in the image of God.
Mm-hmm.
There's a level of holiness that you should understand that we all carry with us, and so if you are a Christian, you really should struggle against arguing for death penalty for that very reason. So,
but like, yeah, I'm curious, like, is that a, because I don't know if I hear that, I don't hear that struggle. Let me be honest, I maybe start to hear that more, but I feel like there is a, I don't feel like there's a struggle with abortion for a lot of, you know, for not for a lot, but largely what comes out of, you know, I guess evangelical circles, right? It's like, no, like abortion, sin, wrong, blah, blah, blah. But I think what does, I do see kind of people who will be like, well, you know, when it says thou shalt not kill, it didn't say murder in the Old Testament. And so this means a little bit something different. And so I hear a lot of justifications that come out around the idea of the death penalty. I think that's one of the things where I think Catholicism is more consistent in often ways, because I've seen their position has been pro-life, like the whole life from the beginning. Like they, you know, it's no contraception. It's no, you know, like the, it's just a round refusal of the idea of life being taken or whatever. I've seen that be more murky among evangelical circles. Maybe that's just me, but I don't see as much struggle.
Personally. So you don't see as much struggle with you don't see people really trying to get behind anti-abortion, or you're saying that you see more proponents for the death penalty.
Yes.
Than the fact that they are, even though they would be evangelicals.
Yeah. What I guess, I don't know if I'm misunderstanding the way you're phrasing it, but ultimately I'm just saying that I see that it's not a struggle often with abortion, that I see that it's like, yeah, that's wrong. Period.
Period. Okay.
And it, gotcha. And the argument is always because that's a human life. But then when I see the conversation that goes about the death penalty, I do not hear, well, that's a human life. I hear other things that in some way, shape or form
rationalize
why a life should be able to be taken by the state in this case. And that is justice.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's really not much more to say.
Yeah. And I want to state also really quick that I gave Doc a bad stat with that 11.3 years that someone's on the death penalty before they die. It's actually longer than that. I was actually reading a stat of average numbers of years of being sentenced to death and exoneration. There is such a growing list of death row inmates who have been exonerated throughout the years based off of either recanted statements or understandings that there was issues in the trial, or, you know, or new evidence arriving. And to me, the thing is that you just can't change that with death. Like, death is too final a decision to leave it in the hands of the state personally. So that's all I got.
Any final thoughts, Doc?
No, I don't think so. I mean, there's a whole other question about, I don't know, can't say I 100% agree with sort of the conflation of how you might feel about abortion is the same way you might feel about the death penalty. But with regards to the death penalty, I would just say, yeah, I think we pretty much covered everything.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. It's definitely something that there's a lot of tension here. And so if you are listening and you kind of are existing in that tension, join us, give us your thoughts, engage with us. This is something that we can sharpen one another and throw out a scenario that we can kind of dig into and how does this work? Because this is going to take a community to come together and truly kind of iron these things out and engage in the at least pursuit of what is true here. And hopefully that truth can compel us to make changes that honor, that whether it be honor life, whether that be honoring life in the death penalty, honoring life by preserving life in gun violence and in many other ways, I'm sure. So, man, Doc, thank you for jumping in with us, man, and struggling through some technical difficulties. But, man, it's been good to have you.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, you know, it's been an interesting conversation. I actually, it's funny, as soon as I said, I don't have anything else more to say, I was going to be like, well, now hold on. No, it's fine. I've said more than enough. So, thank you, guys. I appreciate you having me on.
Absolutely, and I'm sure we will try to have you on more and more, as we, especially going through the politically charged atmosphere that is this election year, and it should be a good couple months, at least for topics of conversation.
Oh, yeah. So, oh, yeah. In the interim, good people, please go and check out Clock Radio Speakers. Y'all took a break last week, right? Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. It's funny. I'm not even plugging my own show, right? Yeah, no. We didn't record this week. Armand is finishing up a music project of his own, and mm-hmm. that means that I'm also
mastering. Right.
Yeah. Armand records. I'm mixing and mastering. So, so we've been busy with that. And but yeah, we're trying not to force episodes. Yeah. You know, for a long time we're really strict about this new week. Got to do a new episode. And, you know, the very nature of our podcast is that we tend to react to what is going on. So because life is never 100% steady, there would be some times where it was a little thin in terms of things to talk about. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've done the podcast for so long now that we know, like, okay, we've got enough to talk about, or nope, mm-hmm. not this week. And we don't want to force it. So, you know, we took the week off. And of course, ironically, we'll come next week. What are we talking about? Nothing new. We got into a whole bunch of people started talking to us on Twitter about this, some random stuff. And we somehow yesterday decided, you know what? We're going to do a retrospective on the Fugees. Why not?
On a whole two albums. Dun, 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 dun.
Oh, no, 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 no. Because we're going to need to really break down exactly what Praz thinks he's doing in that Avenues video. So we've got a lot of the whole extended Refugee Camp All-Stars.
Now, okay.
All the good fun, you know, Lauryn Hill's first album. We got a lot.
Okay. I didn't know that. Cause obviously with Little Brother, you guys focused on two of four of the, you know what I'm saying? And didn't go the other places.
You can blame me for that. I was like, this is about when I checked out on Little Brother. So.
And I was like, man, there's so much other things to discuss.
But there are definitely, it's funny, there are, you know, we try to find common ground in these things. Mm-hmm. There are definitely artists that our mom wants to talk more about. There are definitely artists that I would rather talk, you know, a little bit more about. But we try to find a common ground. So.
Our mom likes the rapidy raps, right?
I'm a recovering rapidy rap fan. Okay. He's got his artist that he really likes. Okay. I've got my artist I really like, and then sometimes
Shades being thrown.
Please.
No, not at all, not at all. I mean, truly, like, that's the whole concept of the show, right?
Yeah.
I'm an MC, I'm a producer. Like, we bring completely different viewpoints based starting from that point. So that's why we hope it works.
It does.
I promise everybody this ends my extended plug.
No,
if you haven't already heard it, check us out on 4th District. I think you'll like it.
Absolutely. And I will say this. I'll be tuning in when you all record the Refugee All. I want no less than 15 minutes dedicated to Melky Sadek. No less than 15 minutes.
I already told Armand. I got some, you know, if we ever do a dating, I said this on Twitter yesterday, I think. If we ever do like a dating episode of the podcast, you know, rule number one, if she doesn't know the opening verse to We're Trying to Stay Alive, she's probably too young for you. Like,
it's a fair assessment.
Conversely, if she knows John Forte's and Praz's verses, you might have a problem on your hands. Oh, like, that's another level of fandom that I don't know if I'm ready for.
Look, we can't derail this conversation because I can talk to you about I, John all day long.
Sounds
so,
like someone
anyway.
Needs to hop on a different podcast.
Anyway.
Yeah, my bad.
No, you're good, you're good. Again, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And guys, engage with us on 4th District. It's way easier to engage with you in a comment section than it is via Twitter.
Yes.
And we definitely check it often and try to jump on there. So for Adam Bean, and this is Dan Duncan and David Perdue, and Doc Beats. This has been Off the Record, and we will catch you potentially next week. Holla.
Peace.
Open, and I'm the maestro for this certain moment, trying to take it sky high, so go alert the stoners. Fear got your guy almost on the verge of blowing it. Bravos, I hear the hand claps, and I know that this here could be my last chance, and I can't ever remember having this chance last, and in this second, this moment here will be past tense. Man, I'm past tense, I'm on the edge of a classic, but slacking got me on the edge of a has-been. Too passive, gotta snatch this moment before I pass it, and face this test like Steve Nash and pass it. I will not be crippled, cast loaves in the oceans, gotta see ripples. Excuses are useless, tools that the fools pick, only got one shot, but it feels like a full clip. For this one moment, patiently waiting in line just to get on it. These players hating on me, I gotta let it go. Put me in the game, coach, I got some better goals. This game so foul, it's sort of pitiful. Tell your people go and grab a stone and get a free throw. And let them know, I love the Lord. But sometimes it's like that, I love me more. Seek his applause, break all your laws. We tear the roof off, homie, we don't need no doors. So now, I stand on top of this. Fear. I have strength in my esophagus. Hear me roar like a young lion. A team called Iron, a product from new science. My confession ain't no fear in me now. Just like an usher, it's my job to move crowds. Once upon a time, I lived in a world that was bound by fear. Escaped his hold, now life's reset. Then I was given grace to break the enemy's net. It's time for the conquerors. Oh, it's my turn? Excuse me, the monster's up. Foe slaying, cruising in this monster truck. It's no playing, giving bruises in this Tonka truck. My circle's where the riders is. A couple Paul and Silas is, and Leonidas is. Kinda sickening how bold this virus is. No sniffling, but so cold like sinuses.
Make room for the misses, the crew full of misfits. Peruse your policies and hack through ISIS. Intrude your embassy, sneak food to your listeners. Pilots, provisioners, and suicide bombers. Musical monsters, martyrs, quick to die for a Zion. Yeah, this is our moment. We're facing our fear, cause faith has appeared. So baby, we'll take it from here.